It's the Hockey Riot edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, new additions to Radio Free Thinker, Australia's issues with climate science, social media as a stool pigeon, and a look at the psychology of riots. Let's begin episode 120.
I'm not a climate scientist.
I'm not a climate scientist.
I'm not a climate scientist either.
Yo, we're climate scientists, and there's no denying this. Climate change is real. Real, 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 real. I'm a climate scientist, not a Clio finalist, no, a climate scientist. Dropping facts all over this. While bitches be crying about a comet. Yes. Climate change is caused by
people.
Earth on like alien has no
people.
Gotta move fast or we'll be forsaken.
We were too busy sucking dick in Copenhagen.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. And for those of you who are psychic, knew that the last episode we had, we actually recorded in front of a live audience. And that live audience this week will actually get to talk. So we have some new people to introduce. Let us begin with Jenna.
Hello. Glad to have my gag removed.
Yay. And we also have Deidre.
Hey, hey, hey.
So we're going to spend the first little bit of our show today sort of introducing you to these new people and to sort of let you know what new voices we'll have on the show, where they come from, what they stand for. But let's begin. So, Jenna, because I picked on you first, who the hell are you? Where do you come from? And what do you do?
I am a current biology or biochemistry student at UBC. I'm doing my PhD. I grew up in a tiny town called Oliver, BC, in the interior of the province, and have been living in Vancouver for the past 9 or 10 years or so.
Cool. Deidre?
I am a political science student at Moulton, looking forward to moving on to a bigger school soon enough. I've been not religious since conception. Grew up in Ladner, BC, and it's good times living in a small farm town.
Not being religious.
Yeah, pretty much.
Jenna, your voice sounds familiar to me. Have I heard you on perhaps another podcast?
I have recorded one episode with the guys of Caustic Soda, which I am a huge fan of, on leprosy. So if you want to hear about people's limbs falling off or not, you can listen to that. And stay tuned for a sequel on tuberculosis.
Ooh, tuberculosis.
Cool.
Yes.
So did you leave anything behind after the leprosy episode? Sorry. Jenna, why did you want to become part of the skeptic community, and in particular, why are you here on our show?
As a research scientist, I have been exposed to a lot of science, but not a lot of really effective communication of science, especially to the public. This was really driven home to me one time when I was interviewed myself for the media, and just seeing the finished product of that and how my words and ideas were twisted into the story really got me motivated to be able to communicate science to a broad audience in an effective way that makes it interesting. I hate sensationalization and misrepresentation of real science in the media, because science and the findings that are coming out now and have, you know, been discovered through the centuries are more interesting on their own than they are when you sensationalize them. And I want to be a part of being able to communicate the truth to people in an interesting and effective way.
And Deidre?
Well, being a loudmouth atheist in a small farm town, sometimes you want to scream a little bit louder, I guess you could say. And I figured, well, you know, I didn't realize that there was a skeptical community in Vancouver, and I wanted to turn it from a hate to a love thing, so I decided to become a part of it, because I'm really interested in forwarding secular, I guess, in legislation kind of thing. I don't like, you know, in politics to be from one-sided, I think that they should be secular, because this is a secular country, right?
Excellent. So, just switching around, Deidre, what does skepticism mean to you in a short, concise sort of soundbite?
Not believing everything that you hear. Picking it apart, criticizing.
Okay. Deidre, Jenna?
The other one. to me, skepticism is engaging in an active way with your own intellect with the world around you.
Ooh, impressive.
You know, Jenna, I recall that you were telling me that you used to sing.
Yes, I still do, given the opportunity.
Do you sing out loud? Sing out loud.
I would if I knew the song, but I regret that I do not.
Oh. So you might be inclined to sing in the future.
Maybe there will be some vocal stylings of Jenna on future episodes of Radio Free Thinker.
Excellent. Well, that's always good
yes.
news.
Well, and actually, on that ironic note, for those people who are listening to our introductory song, it's a climate science song done by climate scientists in Australia, which we will talk about a little bit more. So now I have some hard-hitting questions, just so that, you know, our audience will get to know these people a little bit. And I will start again with Deidre, just because I think she's got probably the strongest feelings on this one. Manned missions or robotic missions to space, which do you favor?
Manned missions.
Why?
Because it's cooler.
Okay.
Because I want to go.
Well, he said manned missions, though.
Sorry. We can't be as sexist as we've always been in here. Personed missions.
Person missions?
Deidreed missions.
Humanoid? I can say humanoid, because that way
there are humanoid robots.
Sentient being missions.
Yeah. Biologic sentient beings.
Okay. Of earthly origin.
Sure.
Yeah. Just to make sure we have all our bases covered.
Yeah, we don't want to rule it like Vulcans or something.
And Jenna?
Definitely robotic missions.
And because?
The cost effectiveness and the biological practicality of this, there's no contest for efficiency and cost efficiency. It's all about the robots.
Okay. So, again, on science and getting a little bit, some people think that we should pour a lot of money into theoretical science and research. Other people say, no, we should take that money and do it more practical, you know, feeding people as opposed to building large space telescopes. Your opinion, Deidre?
That's probably something I'd have to think more about. I couldn't give you an answer to that right now.
Okay.
I think that there really needs to be balance in all things. So I am a strong proponent of there's really no useless thing to study. You really never know when a piece of knowledge is going to come in handy in something practical in the future. However, this does not mean that I think we should put all of our efforts or even the majority of our efforts into things that don't have a short-term practical application. Obviously, we're trying to learn things to use them eventually. And for the things that we have already learned, we should be able to pour resources into learning how to use those in the short term.
Do you have any science questions for them, Ethan?
I'm curious. I mean, I think a lot of us skeptics here, we kind of have big issues that we take issue with, for instance. You know, I have a sort of a natural desire to crush alternative medicine because I think it's not evidence-based and it's, in fact, quite dangerous. And I know Don has his own skeptical, angry points. I'm just curious, you know, what are your skeptical points that you find infuriating?
Actually, before we go there, and on this very note, Jenna, define for me what you think to be alternative medicine. I mean, people who listen to our show have a good, clear understanding, I think, of what we consider to be alternative. What do you think is alternative medicine in the sense that I think Ethan's trying to convey?
Personally, I don't use the term a heck of a lot, so I don't have really my own conception of the idea so much as the way that I understand it when other people use that term. And I understand it to be things that are outside the world of the Western modern medicine umbrella, including the things that undergo the peer review process and clinical testing and that kind of thing, whether it be procedural or chemical therapies.
Well, right now something that's bothering me is this issue between whether parents or I guess the government should be choosing the way that education runs. So I've seen a lot of groups, religious-based groups, faith-based groups, whatever you want to call it, especially in Abbotsford, of course. I think there's one in Burnaby right now that are, you know, advocating for, you know, their own perception to be taught in school. And I guess I don't really feel like, you know, that faith-based groups should be picking how kids are being taught, especially when they're trying to fight against, you know, same-sex education being taught to young kids. So that's definitely one of the bones that's picking me right now.
Excellent. Good.
Not sure if that was medical, but it's interesting to hear. Well, one of the things, and again, I think Ethan's getting part of this, you know, some things like homeopathy, acupuncture, those sort of things are things that, you know, they're not evidence-based. But what about some things like experimental treatments? And at what point does an experimental treatment deserve to be funded? I mean, do you guys have any opinions on that? There was a big thing we were talking about before about a procedure of clearing the arteries using... where they scrape out the arteries in the neck to increase blood flow to reduce the effects of MS in some patients. Now, the experimental evidence on that is dubious to begin with, but it's still on the go. And some people think that the government should pay for this experimental treatment. Some people think you don't. At what point do you think an experimental treatment is no longer experimental and valid? And do you have any opinions on that? They're looking at me quite stunned here. Sorry, folks.
I think that the line that you draw between how much research is enough research is always going to be somewhat arbitrary. Now, as I sort of alluded to in my previous statement about sort of the modern medicine scheme and the way that things are run through specific procedures and three levels of trials and whatnot, I'm not saying that that is completely adequate, but that's the infrastructure we have in place now, because statistically that has been what is effective. So as far as experimental procedures, more research is always a good thing. And if something is still considered experimental under the guidelines that we have already set out, it's probably not a good idea to prematurely move that forward. My mind always goes back to the thalidomide example and how that actually drove new standards for what drugs have to go through. For those of you who don't know or may not remember, there's a drug called thalidomide that came in basically two flavors that were purified together, and people tested one, decided that both were probably okay. A reasonable assumption, actually, but it turns out that the one caused severe birth defects. Unfortunately, the other one was actually a treatment for morning sickness. So, of course, this caused a generation full of birth defects in a lot of women. So this example always illustrates to me how the rigorous setup that we have decided as a society is the minimum for such that a therapy should be applied should probably be adhered to.
Deirdre? You can guess. It's okay.
There's no wrong answer.
Yeah, here. No. Maybe your opinion is you have no opinion. That's valid. Have you ever thought about, you know, what standards you would use as a skeptic to make judgments on medical news that you read about?
Being skeptical, I guess.
Good. So let's go to...
Well, why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker? We'll be back with more with our new cast members and more amazing content on the show as usual.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
So, you know, we were talking about, you know, heavy stuff, medical. So maybe we should, you know, lighten up a bit. And let's go to something, you know, frothy and light. Let's talk about religion. Again, one of the big divides in the atheist skeptical community is the difference between spiritualism and religion / theism. So, Deirdre, you being a political science person, and you seem to have some issues with religion in general. Do you make a distinction between religion and spiritualists? So spiritualists, you know, those people who don't have a god per se, but cosmic consciousness, those sort of less defined beliefs, but are still very much super or unnatural, sort of.
It kind of all feels the same to me, in all honesty. I mean, I'm sure that there is some distinction when you get down to the terminology of it all, but ultimately, it all kind of feels like the same thing. I'm not someone that really believes in anything supernatural. I think everybody is spiritual in their own way, whether it's the flying spaghetti monster or astrology. I think everyone can be spiritual in their own way, as I am, but spiritual to me is not, you know, it's not the supernatural.
So you said you have a spirituality. Can you feel comfortable expressing what you mean by your own sense of spirituality?
I would call it genuine experience and things that I enjoy and things that make me happy, ultimately. My pursuit in life, that's what would be spiritual to me.
Groovy. And Jana?
So I do draw somewhat of a distinction, depending on how we define the terms, just in the way that the sort of infrastructures, I guess, are used by people in society. So organized religions, especially those that are influencing policy and educational practices and that kind of thing, obviously have a different place. Well, I say obviously, for me, have a much different place than a sort of a different type of feeling. So those that consider themselves spiritual or talk about some sort of spirituality in a more nebulous, spread out terms, these tend to be more personal, private feelings that I think of as a tool. So the same way that science can be used as a tool to very effectively explore the physical world, I think a sort of feeling of spirituality can be used as a fairly effective tool to explore some of the more ethical and moral issues that connect people in a society to each other. And so thinking of yourself as sort of a cog in a spiritual wheel, if you will, I guess that's a gear, not a wheel, but I think can be just as effective a tool in investigating and probing and really thinking skeptically about your own actions as you can use science as a tool to explore the physical world around you.
You know, and that's just a perfect lead into my next question. So one of the things recently, Sam Harris released a book called The Moral Landscape, and it addressed the question as to, can science derive ethics, or ethics sort of a separate, the ought, and we can never ever use the is. For those people who are into philosophy will know that the distinctions. For those who don't, the ought is what we should do, the is what we empirically see in the world. And that ethics always deals with what we should do and is sort of divorced in the sense of figuring out what it is from what actually happens in the world. Sam Harris's book essentially said, well, no, actually, we can kind of delineate a certain degree of what we ought to do by scientific and empirical evidence. Hogwash, or do you agree with that, Jenna?
So, I strongly agree that you can definitely probe pretty much everything by some sort of scientific inquiry. And especially in the field of ethics, I mean, I'm not saying it's going to be easy or that we necessarily have the methodology now or the understanding to do it. But basically, I truly believe that all of the ethics and moral issues are basically a construction of biology. Our brain is a really amazing piece of machinery that you need to come up with these constructs. And so the fact that they come from biology can then necessarily be investigated using somewhat of the same terms or the like.
That sounds very similar to some of the theories behind evolutionary psychology. I'm curious where you would weigh in on that particular minefield.
As in many fields that are, I would think, partially explored, similar to evolutionary psychology, there are truths and misconceptions. Whenever I come back to the adage of a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. And so finding some sort of correlations and that kind of thing in those areas will lead people to make sort of predictions or hypotheses that may or may not bear out to be true. But I think we are biological organisms, and in some way everything that we are going to do derives from our biology, the same way that everything a bacteria does derives from its specific biology.
Utilitarian, Kantian, or Aristotelian?
I'm sorry, I'm a bench scientist and don't understand any of those words.
Okay. Deirdre, question to you. A, if you don't know the words, that's great. And two, what's your view on ethics and science?
Well, I'm actually just started one of Sam Harris's books. I believe it's called The Ethics of Blank. It was this book that just came out before The Moral Landscape. I can't remember the name of it now. But no, I definitely agree with Jenna in the fact that I really think that everything is biologically based, you know, down to every emotion. And I think a lot of human experience is because of that. I really do think that you don't, you know, a lot of people think, oh, well, if we don't have religion or any of that, how are we going to know right from wrong? But, you know, growing up with my own experience, I know right from wrong, and I've never been religious in my entire life. And I think you could just kind of have a sense, you know, you understand if something hurts, bad. If something feels good, right.
No, you're wrong.
can I add one last thing to that conversation?
Yes.
That just because I think that things are derived from this, you know, complex or simple, depending on how you look at biochemistry, I don't think that that makes anything any less meaningful or amazing. The fact that these can, that everything in our experience and in our emotions and in our morality can derive from these very simple components, I think is kind of magical on its own and doesn't need anything else to make it meaningful.
Well, to move on to our last sort of area, climate change. And the idea of nuclear power, carbon tax, those sort of things. Jenna, since you were talking, thoughts, opinions, cares, discares? I'm allowed to make up words. Remember, ground rules. So do you know what climate change is? Do you care about it? Do you think nuclear power is a great way out of it? Carbon tax, great way out of it? Some other weird alien technology that will land on the planet in 2013 somewhere in Alaska?
I believe that climate change is real. I also believe that it's at least in part and most likely the greater part caused by humans. And I believe that it's a great threat to everything on the planet, including us, and that that's a bad thing. So I believe that we should be taking steps to avoid it. I don't have a particular stance on the absolute best way to do it because I don't know. What I do believe is that people only change if it's either easy or necessary. And so I think we're reaching, I don't think it's ever going to be easy, but I think we're reaching the point where people will begin to realize it's necessary. And I actually do have a lot of faith in human ingenuity and sort of the selfish urge of people to change when it really matters to them, and hopefully it's in time.
And Deirdre?
I really don't know about the best way to go about it, but I do think that it is one of those things that we're going to leave until the last minute, until it's, you know, we start to feel uncomfortable, until it's in your own backyard. And I really do think that we have the resources and the skill to make change. but I think we need to get on it.
Excellent. And just so that he doesn't feel left out, Ethan, do you have anything to add to this whole issue of climate change?
Actually, Don, I do.
Ooh.
You see, it turns out that not so much me, but some Australian scientists have something to add about climate change.
Segment change.
Thank you for noting that for our listeners who weren't paying attention. Shame on you, by the way. So last week, a group of Australian scientists decided to organize a new united front to deal with the increasing denial of climate change. Anne-Marie Arabia is the CEO of Australia's peak scientific body, FAST, the Federation of Australian Science and Technology Societies, and is organizing this new campaign. Over 200 scientists have marched on Australian Parliament to protest the actions of the Australian government promoting misinformation of climate change. Now, recently, the government has proposed a controversial new carbon emission tax, which has been slammed by political opponents, saying it will cause the price of fuel to rise and cause job loss across the country. So it's become a very political issue. And now both sides are putting out their public awareness campaigns. And scientists are very concerned that the actual true facts of the world are not getting out there. And worst of all, it appears that scientists are feeling the brunt of the anger from the climate-denying public. Dr. Arabia received death threats the morning of the actual event, which police were investigating. In addition, a number of the country's top climate scientists, including several at the Australian National University, were targeted by death threats and reported receiving abusive phone calls for months. Eventually, the university was forced to move its scientists to a more secure location. It turns out this cyber abuse has been stepping up in Australia, and perhaps not a coincidence, the country has been ravaged by drought, deadly bushfires, floods, and dozens of people have been killed. The economy has been hit badly, and it's become a very visceral reminder of climate change, and it's obviously become a very sore point between those who say that climate change is not happening and those that say that it is. Now, the campaign that they're starting here, they really hope can restore public trust and confidence in science, which has been shaken by the misinformation put out there by climate change deniers. On Monday, CICERO, the country's top research facility, launched a website that allows the public to see greenhouse gas measurement data. And this is sort of the old-fashioned climbing CO2 graph, and it's very fancy and professional looking. And this is all part of an educational outreach program to get the public informed about climate science to counter the pseudoscience that's currently out there. So I figure, Jenna, you're really interested in public outreach and science outreach. What do you think about their lofty goals to get the public aware about climate science?
What I was really happy to read in this account was not only that the scientists were trying to get the message of climate change out there, which is, of course, very important, and, you know, to get truth to stand above untruths is a good idea, but really the way that they were going about this was a deeper level of education in being able to tell people, these are our results, but more importantly, this is how we got there. And so it's one of those give a man a fish, teach a man to fish type things. You know, you're either telling someone information and hoping that they pick out the truth, or giving them the tools that saying, you know, this is how we got there. In future, this is what you should look for in how a piece of, you know, factual information is arrived at, so that you can decide for yourself whether or not that piece of information is valid. And I'm hoping that the more prevalent that approach becomes, the more people are going to be able to really judge what's being being told to them. And I think often scientists put themselves on this pedestal and say, you know, oh, this is our science, just trust us. And I thought that this approach was actually really refreshing coming from the scientific community to the greater public.
Jenna. I don't know where you've been hiding. But
in a lab, haven't I told you?
Yes. Well, so in the first instance, I mean, obviously, as a good skeptic and all that, I don't disagree with your whole premise that, yes, part of promoting the scientific method is to promote the reasoning and all that behind. But one, I think most scientists and most skeptics aren't, this is the way it is, trust us. In fact, one of the handicaps that most skeptics and scientists have is we have this driving urge to explain why we think something is right. It is one of the reasons why we're a skeptic in the first place, is we have this desire for explanation, for understanding, and we want to project that onto other people because we don't believe in dogma. We don't think people should just believe it because. But when we have an issue like this, and you have the other side, those climate change deniers who just sit there and say, listen, if we do that, one of the big things in Australia right now is a carbon tax. That's what they're the sparking this whole big controversy is, are they going to have a carbon tax or not? And you get one person on there with a 30-second soundbite who sits there and says, listen, if we get the carbon tax, 100,000 Australians are going to lose their job in the first year. It's going to cost our economy $5 billion. I know these things. I'm a meteorologist. Trust me. You, on the other hand, are going to go on the air and you're going to say, well, let me explain to you the complex interactions between the environment and our CO2 emissions and how over time these 1.3 and these so I agree with you that this website is great, this initiative is good, but it strikes me as only being half the battle, that we're tying our hands behind our back against an enemy who has no reticence to take a brick and slug us over the head.
I absolutely agree with you, and I think that it's a travesty that people do tie their own hands behind their back by the language that they use. And I don't think that this type of education should come at the expense of a strong, unified message, because like you said, that's something that you're going against, but it is essential as an additive to that to make the true message stand out. Because otherwise, if you have two messages of equal strength going head to head, it's going to be a random selection which one you're going to believe, and or, you know, what the guy's hair looked like. But if you have that message that is backed up not only by the evidence, which, as you were saying, the scientists and skeptics like to go through, but that's a little bit distinct from what's going on here, because it's not backing up evidence. Is also just sort of more facts, more information, but this approach is saying this is how you get to it. So it's like a lesson as opposed to a lecture.
Well, I think that there's actually two things that we can point out about this. Is one, despite the fact that these people who are presenting this united front of scientists, there's no indication that they're skeptics. Keep in mind that scientists don't necessarily think of themselves as skeptics. Skepticism as a movement is completely new. I mean, how many times have we berated scientists for taking a 30-second TV spot and then going back to their laboratory? They may not even realize that they're just another talking head out there. And until they can bring someone out there like a Bill Nye or a Carl Sagan or somebody, or Jenna, then
or Deirdre. I mean, she's not a scientist, but she can be a talking head.
Sure, why not? Until they bring someone like that up, they're on the losing side here because they're not pundits. They don't know how to debate somebody who has gone through journalism school and punditry school and is able to reduce your well-reasoned scientific theory down to it's going to cost, you know, Joe Smith his job.
Well, and to add the complexity to this is, we've mentioned this before, where we're starting to get filter bubbles, right? Where people who sit there and they watch, well, they listen to talk radio. Well, they will listen to their radio station and probably only that radio station because they don't have a lot of time because they're playing their Xbox or whatever they're doing with the rest of the time. And if the person they're listening to is someone like Rush Limbaugh or the Australian equivalent, then they're only actually ever going to hear the one side versus the other. And that causes a whole other sort of complexity to the whole issue that I guess we can't really do, except we can force them into re-education camps where they will learn the scientific myth. No, okay.
I think you've been listening too much to Rush Limbaugh.
But on that note, just to close up this topic, if anyone subscribes on iTunes to a video podcast called Media Watch, which I've mentioned innumerable times before. In the last, not the last episode, but the last five or six episodes, they've had two or three shows exclusively on this climate change debate and how you have pundit radio totally maligning the actual science, the actual viewpoint of what climate science is and all that sort of. It's very good. Media Watch on iTunes, great thing.
All right, well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Well, how best to explain it? You've seen me in X-Men. The character I am, Professor Charles Xavier, if you remember, he can control things with the power of his mind, can make people do things and see things. So I thought, what if you can do that for real? I mean, not in a comic book world, but in the real world.
All right.
So in my film, I play a man who controls the world with his mind.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah, for instance, I'm walking along. And I see this beautiful girl, and I think I'd like to see her naked, and so all her clothes fall off.
All her clothes fall off?
Yes, and she's scrabbling around to get them back on again, but even before she can get her knickers on, I've seen everything. You know, I've seen it all.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We've already seen everything.
Okay. It's a comedy, is it?
No.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So anyone who's anyone has heard that when the Vancouver Canucks lost the Stanley Cup, riots broke out here in Vancouver. Very distressing. We're going to talk now about the psychology of these riots. Yes, Don?
Who's to blame when a riot breaks out?
Who is to blame, Don?
I thought it'd be a good opportunity to turn this sort of negative event that happened to our city as sort of a learning opportunity and examine some of the psychology of riots. There are, of course, a lot of other issues that will come out of this particular event, such as, you know, the city's preparedness for the riot, its response either over or under the police force. But for right now, I'm going to try and limit our discussion to the psychology. So first of all, just to get out of the way, there usually needs to be at least some physical preconditions for a riot. These sort of things are like a highly charged emotional event, like, I don't know, a Stanley Cup hockey game, a large number of people concentrated in a small space, like downtown around the big screen TVs they had, and a lack of paths of rapid dispersal for these groups after the event, i.e. why they shut down the SkyTrain and the buses. I mean, I don't know which came first, the riot or the shutting down, but once they had sort of done that, everyone was kind of trapped downtown, and that sort of set up the physical conditions for the riot.
And that was actually a huge impact in '94 riots, which also occurred after Vancouver lost the Stanley Cup, is that police just sort of cordoned off the downtown core, and people couldn't get out. And they're lobbing tear gas in there, and people are panicking, and it creates a kind of a big perfect storm.
Help, help, I'm being repressed.
Yes.
So once we have sort of the physical conditions out there, there are some things that you kind of need in order to happen for a riot really to come into. One of them is group identity. Sports games, more than any other activity in our society, not uniquely, but more than most others, sort of glorifies in this idea of group identity. We look around, you know, as the final game was approaching, and we could see everyone starting to wear their team jersey. Notice their team and a jersey. I mean, even the name itself. I mean, it wasn't a shirt, right? It was a jersey. It was something special you put on to show that this makes me part of this group. It's a signal of my identity. It's like gang colors sort of thing.
Well, in addition...
Or game colors.
Well, you mentioned gang colors, but that's actually a good point as well, because a lot of other riots usually have some way of identifying who the oppressed is and who they're rioting against. Whether it's like a race riot, usually the people who are rioting are the oppressed visible minority, or whether it's something like the G20 riots or the riots in Seattle, usually you saw people sort of dressed in looks like clothes they haven't changed from the 60s against, you know.
But that's why actually the sports makes it even stronger case than that, because again, you know, you had in the G20 riots, you had some people who were dressed in black and they were the anarchists. Mm-hmm. You had some people who were the granola types, you know, let's all give peace a chance. And they all kind of had their own sort of uniforms. But in this particular case, everybody was wearing a Vancouver Canuck jersey. Mm-hmm. It may have been an older jersey, but everyone was this. You had the face painting, right? You had the whole nine yards of it. You even had, you know, the whole group activities, which, again, were done in smaller in these other ones. But in sports, it amplifies all these psychological cues. So you have, like, the big wave that goes, you know, through the stadium, right? And you have the towel waving and all sorts of other events. And all these serve to sort of strip the individual of their identity and replace it with that of the group. You know, it's no longer the I. It is the we, mm-hmm. right? And you have this sort of sense of de-individualization happening. This is where, you know, the individual no longer feels that it is them, but it is us. And in doing so, they kind of lose their own sense of personal responsibility. It becomes diffused into the group. And they assume that the group, acting en masse, becomes the moral agent, and they are just part of this massive zeitgeist sort of entity that is doing the actions. It's no longer me, it is us, and therefore I am no longer responsible. And then, of course, at that point, you know, you have a mob.
And the other neat tie into this is you see this sort of thing with, like, military as well, where you have wartime atrocities. How can they possibly happen? How could ordinary people become vicious monsters? Well, they're all wearing uniforms. They're all identifying themselves as, you know, the army of whatever nation. And they start to visualize what they're doing, not as individuals, but as, you know, this has to be done for the safety of our nation, et cetera, et cetera.
And on a much less militant note, there have actually been studies on group psychology in general, and specifically group intelligence, where they showed that the intelligence of the group, or their capability in being able to perform a task, wasn't actually correlated with the individual intelligences of the people in the group. And so really a group entity is a different being than the individuals that make it up.
Cool.
Wild.
So we have now this sort of group entity. Another important aspect that comes in this is the idea of a perceived injury to the group. Now, obviously, like I say, the identities are Canucks, right? And there was this growing sense that this was our team. I mean, I was commenting so much, if anyone asked, how I thought it was ironic that everyone said, my team scored, our team, right? Because they were buying into this. And once you sort of had this, you created a sort of us versus them condition. You know, it was our team, us versus them, the other team. And then there was this perceived injury. We lost the cup, or some people thought we were robbed of the cup. So now, you know, we have this sort of unified group feeling an instinctive urge to defend us from them, the people who did this injury to us, right? But of course, the them is not really a physical thing. It's sort of an amorphous idea. So what you do is you have this sort of this need to defend, to lash out, and it's directed at whatever's handy. And what was handy was the city itself. And I find it so ironic that, you know, people had such a strong tie to a team that they had no control or actually ownership over it, and it seemed to them to be more a part of their identity than the actual city they lived, worked, and actually owned or controlled, you know, I mean, property and via and all that. So in an odd sort of way, they were defending what they thought they owned against what they actually owned, and you had this sense of perceived injury. Now, of course, injury in itself is not such an important thing if there isn't also an emotional relevance. As I say, people thought this was actually a part of them. Now, we often, you know, we have other group identities, right? I mean, we had an election recently where we had NDP, Green, Liberal, conservative. And at least in our society, when one group lost, this didn't bring out, you know, rioting in the street. Should have, but didn't.
It has in the past, though, remember.
For elections? I don't think we've ever had an election.
Haven't we had
I don't think we've ever had an election riot.
Really?
So if any of our listeners are out there, you can email us, our new email at info@radiofreethinker.com, and let us know if we've ever actually had an election riot as opposed to a political riot. We've had political riots.
Well, yeah, I guess, yeah.
So going back on the topic, most of these events are either not that important to our lives. Sadly, hockey seems to be more important than the governance of our country, going back to my other theme, or they're less substantious. So we had the Olympics, which were important. I mean, we had Team Canada. But I mean, really, Team Canada only existed for a couple of weeks, whereas the Canucks have been in town for anyone?
41 years.
Yeah. Or less dramatic. I mean, many other events, like I say, like the Olympics, right? There's a set number of games. You know, there's the one big game, you win, you lose, and that's the end of it. But with the way the NHL set up the Stanley Cup, it's the best of seven, and you're never quite sure, you know, where it's going to end. And with every extra game, you get this ramping up of fervor, of energy, of all that, that just builds up. So we have Game 7 of Stanley Cup. It's a home game. Possible first win ever for the Vancouver Canucks. The emotional stakes in this game were extremely high for those people in it. And then we add into that a sort of escapist element. I mean, what else is in the news? Well, there's war in Libya and the Middle East and Afghanistan. Our economy is doing good. We're all worried about our jobs. Reality itself is just, it's very depressing. And if only for a little while, we can feel like our team, we are the best people in the world by winning the Stanley Cup. It would be so great. The level of emotions is so high. And, of course, when you lose, it is such a strong, strong attack on this. We're just brought right down. And in such a level, you get this strong emotional charge. And this emotional charge then becomes very, very contagious because not everyone will feel it equally. But you have all this energy just ready to spark.
I also can't help but feel that some of the coverage before the game, not only about the game itself, could have sort of helped to be that spark. So, for example, almost all the media coverage, especially of the final series, there are all these ominous predictions of riots if the Canucks did happen to lose the cup, and all these throwbacks to, oh, I hope nothing happens like it did in 94. And this occasional reference in the media really did bleed into the popular conversations. Everything from bus conversations to everything on social media, almost every conversation about the series at one point or another had someone saying, oh, well, I hope people aren't stupid enough to repeat what happened in 94. So I can't help but think that this type of almost riot priming might have played a role in these scenarios by sort of either implanting an idea or strengthening an idea in people who maybe already had some violent energy to get out, as well as sort of preparing those who might not be ready for any sort of violence, that there was such an eventuality and sort of prepared them sort of sub-psychologically for this climactic event.
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that because the police earlier after the riot were saying that a lot of it was provoked by a small group of people who came downtown specifically for the purpose of causing trouble. And there were like photos of people dressed up all in black with t-shirts saying Vancouver Riot 2011 and that sort of thing. And there was this sort of sense that there were people out there who wanted to cause trouble and were looking for an excuse to cause trouble, win or lose. They were going down there, they were going to get drunk, and they were going to get rowdy, and things were going to happen. And there was, you're kind of right, there was this sort of foreboding in the media that, you know, oh, something bad is going to happen, no matter what happens, there's going to be a car flipped over or something like that.
And I think that that type of attitude with the preparedness of, for the riot could actually occur on a spectrum. So you have on the one extreme the people who are dressed in black and, you know, have crowbars in their backpacks. And then maybe people in the middle of that are just, they're going down and they're kind of aware that something might happen. It might be exciting. It might be something that's going on. And then other people that are going down hoping that something doesn't happen, but still with that knowledge, having some sort of energy to that effect.
And, you know, this leads into the next thing is this emotional chain reaction. I mean, humans are pack animals, right? We are very much in tune with the emotions of those in our group. In fact, we have specialized brain cells called mirror neurons that not only allow us to see what others are doing, but to feel as though we were the ones doing it. This emotional link has allowed humans to create very interconnected and very complex societies. But it also means that a certain number of people can have a strong emotional effect on others. And that, you know, that this can create a sort of chain reaction. As some people have these strong emotions, it goes into others. They start mirroring this sort of sense of heightened energy, and this sort of nuclear chain reaction where every member, although perhaps reacting in slightly different reasons or justifications, feel the same sort of strong emotion, which in turn amplifies and perpetuates it. The loss of the Canucks created in some more than others a sense of anger, but the need to retaliate because of the number of people concentrated downtown, this sort of formed a critical mass that in turn resulted in a explosion that was the riot. An important sense, too, is this sort of idea of false consensus. When we see someone express a strong emotion, we tend to empathize with that person. We also project our own reasons for that expression. So one person is upset about the game because they're just angry they lost a cup. Someone else lost a bet. Another one feels upset because, you know, the rich owners made millions of dollars off this, but, you know, what did we get out of this? And so on. So although there may be an infinite number of justifications for each individual to react violently, they project their own personal reasons onto the mob as though the whole mob had the same feelings. Because, and this sort of creates a feedback loop that my feelings are somehow being reflected back to me by the mob, and the mob is feeling my emotions, and you get, again, this sort of cyclical effect. And ironically enough, the more isolated the group, limited in size at least, the stronger this feedback goes. When we look at the riots, it's rarely actually thousands of people doing violence. It actually is these small little bands that are going around and actually perpetrating the acts of violence, right? And think of these as sort of little eddies or tornadoes in a larger storm, who are feeding off the local emotion of the band and feeling emboldened by the passive acquiescence of the larger group or the bystanders, witnesses, of their actions, which of course leads into the next idea, is this whole bystander effect, right? The bystander effect, for those who aren't familiar, is essentially a psychological thing that when we're in a group, we actually tend to feel less personally responsible, like the mob, but slightly different, than if we were alone or whatever, because we think someone else is going to do something. You know, I don't want to be the first, I don't want to stand out in the group, so I'm going to sort of take a step back.
There's been some pretty famous examples of the bystander effect involving, like, public murders and such that I'm sure many listeners are already familiar with.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, as a result of this bystander effect, ironically enough, the larger group of people, the less an individual feels responsible, you know, the more they're less likely they act. So in a sense, this also feeds into another aspect of it, which is almost the exact opposite. It's sort of the celebrity effect. And this is, I think, almost a newer version of it. But right now, you know, the new elements in a modern riot is the ever-present social media, be it the 24/7 news cycle or the ubiquitous cell phone cam. The effect of this is to almost goad people into performing for the cameras, a ready-made audience for the YouTube universe, waiting for that person or group to do that memorable thing, like jump over an ad hoc bomb fire in the streets, throw a brick through a store window, or just lie down in the street and make out like there's no tomorrow.
Everybody wants to be the new viral sensation.
Exactly. You know, the whole celebrity culture that we live in currently.
And for sure, I think that in the case of the Vancouver riots, the bystanders actually played a much more active role than you were just talking about a second ago because of all that social media. The news coverage, the, you know, bigger news outlets constantly during the riot were pointing out that there are cameras and recording devices everywhere. And the photographer bystanders really increased the effective size of the watching crowd. So now not only are the rioters sort of performing for those around them, but each of them is then performing for, you know, that person times 100 for all those that would be seeing the footage. And so it sort of creates this interesting effect where you're decreasing the anonymity that's helping you to perpetrate these acts while increasing the celebrity factor. And I'm sure that there's some really conflicting psychology that took place during this riot. And I also thought it was really interesting how the news and the police forces interpreted these at different times. So the day of the riot, everything that you heard from the police, from the news media was, oh my goodness, can everybody just put down their cameras and go the heck home? Like, get this crowd dispersed. Why are you guys hanging around? This is deplorable. And the next day, oh, I'm sorry, can you please send me your pictures?
You know, it's funny because actually another sort of interesting effect of a riot, not our riot, almost every riot, is sort of the backlash. There's almost always a collective sense of guilt and remorse by the city or group for the actions that happened. You know, we didn't mean for it to get so wild. How could this have happened here? The population in mass cannot understand how their own people could perpetuate such violence in their own city. And they need, to a degree, to have a sort of sense of vengeance or retaliation by the population on those they blame for causing the violence. This is where we hear how, you know, the riot was organized by anarchists or criminals were at the root of it. And of course, in an iron, again, in a weird sort of way, we then start getting into a scapegoat sort of mentality. The irony is the same very mob psychology that created the riot in the first place also plays its role in creating the scapegoat afterwards. We as a people do not like the idea that we are capable of such meaningless violence. The us now is the city, and the them are the rioters. The injury, the riot itself. And so it follows the same mob logic, down to the point where people are being fired for their job just being photographed downtown during the riot. There's no trial, there's no attempt at understanding why or how. It's sort of guilt by association.
Well, I actually heard, and this was, I heard this from sort of gossip, but one of the rioters was photographed or videotaped or something, and it got on YouTube, went viral. And this person, who obviously took part in the riot, that was bad, but started to get death threats. And his family started to get death threats. And as you can imagine, this is pretty traumatic for someone who, you know, your child is getting a death threat, you're afraid that your kids go to school now. And this isn't the way to deal with this problem. You don't, you know, attack the family of the rioter. And it's sort of this weird, on the one hand, you have people feeling, oh, the riot was so horrible and was so violent. Now let's send hateful messages to the people who rioted.
Yeah, and again, because, you know, it's no longer sort of me doing it, it is the city. I am just part of this amorphous mob that is now the city. Mm-hmm. And again, it's this weird sort of perpetuation. I don't know, human psychology, it's just weird.
It is really weird.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with our skeptical highlights after this.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we're running out of time. Let's go on to our skeptical highlights. I have a really neat one, a bit different from the usual. That is the movie Paul, starring Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, and Seth Rogen. Now, why is this movie a skeptical highlight? Well, the plot of the movie is that two British nerds come to America to attend Comic-Con, and they take an RV, and they explore famous UFO sites like Roswell. Along the way, they pick up a real alien, and surprisingly, the themes of this movie involve a lot of skepticism, not just about aliens, but also religion, including a very interesting scene about creationism versus evolution. I won't spoil it, so just go watch it, and think of me when you laugh.
And my skeptic highlight is a book launch and discussion group, Stop Signs, Cars and Capitalism on the Road to Economic, Social, and Ecological Delay. Vancouver City Councillor Dave Cadman and author Yves Engler and others who oppose the highway expansion in the Lower Mainland will be at the SFU Harbor Center, room 1700, this Monday, June 27th at 7 p.m. I don't believe there's any cost to go to this. There'll be some more information on our website about that. Jenna, Deidre, do you guys have any skeptic highlights? Well, I have one for you. Next week, we'll have Jenna and Deidre back on the show. And that should be a highlight for someone's week.
Yeah, totally. That's a highlight for me.
Woohoo!
Yeah. All right. Well, remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your preferred podcast aggregator. Check out our website, www.radiofreethinker.com, to read all our blogs and show notes. And, of course, if you have any comments, criticisms, or hateful messages to send us, email us.
Keep quiet.
What?
Keep quiet about them. We don't want to hear your criticisms or anything.
We like your criticisms. They're
okay,
great.
Okay. Sorry. If you have any comments, criticisms, or what have you, what can they do, Ethan?
They can email us at info@radiofreethinker.com. We look forward from hearing from you.
Sorry, what was that email address again? It was new, wasn't it?
Is new. info@radiofreethinker.com.
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 And that's enough of saying that. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening. See you next week.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Jenna saying, remember, we don't know as much as we think we do.
This is Deidre. Peace out, Girl Scout.
Then there's the utter misery that is...